Minutes later, McCarter was pacing on the concrete pier of the JCAD's island, ignoring the concerned and confused Marines who were milling around, trying to look useful. After the Brit had radioed Colonel Steindl, they had stormed onto the island expecting to take down Phoenix Force, only to discover the team was actually the good guys, and the ones they were after were already long gone. James had to be almost physically restrained from jumping into the water in pursuit of the infiltrators. McCarter wouldn't hear of it. The Brit wasn't happy when he was caught in any situation unprepared. They didn't have the equipment to pursue the infiltrators on their escape route, which obviously led from the entrance point under the incinerator into the ocean. As the minutes ticked away, the infiltrators were getting farther and farther away. The next boat that roared from the atoll to the makeshift island included Colonel Steindl and Captain Kiekhofer. They left the watercraft with obvious reluctance.
Relax. None of the chemicals are left.
None?
Well, one of your plastic containers. They must have heard us coming and abandoned it below.
You mean below?
Are we getting gear or not?
There's none to give you. We don't have SEAL gear here.
Spear guns, anything? We removed scuba gear from the guys they left behind.
We brought over a couple of spear guns. That's all we've got.
Great. I'll take them both.
He grabbed the two spear guns from the boat and headed back inside the incinerator, followed by the captain and the colonel. The interior was now filled with soldiers and the JCAD's emergency crew, who were merely standing around. There was nothing for any of them to do.
Have you got the search boats out?
I deployed them myself. We got every spare vessel searching the area.
The colonel stopped and stared at the new trap door in the bottom of the incinerator.
This is where they came in?
Yeah, and it's how we're gonna follow them out. Cal, you're with me.
Yeah, I thought as much.
James quickly stripped to his shorts and dragged on scuba fins and mask, then grabbed a few extra lights from the corpses in the basement cavern. Lastly, he took one of the spear guns McCarter offered him and stepped into the water. The light on his forehead was feeble against the murk in the water, which was a rusty color that James realized had to be mostly silt. He examined the framework of the tunnel as he went, curious as to how it was built. The frame was composed of steel girders that had been bolted together in a triangular shape, then linked for a three-sided tunnel framework. The frame had been placed secretly underwater at some point during the construction of the concrete island, then covered with the scrap concrete slabs and chunks that formed the base of the island. If the concrete overlay was performed carefully, the inside of the tunnel would have been filled with only small chunks that could be cleared by hand. Not a bad plan, James had to admit. The water was filled with litter, which was about all their lights could illuminate, and James felt as if he were swimming in muck. He wondered how in the world he would be able to see an enemy before the enemy saw him. That, combined with the claustrophobia nipping at his nerves, was the kind of nightmarish scenario that could get even experienced SEALs trembling. He wondered how well McCarter was doing just a few feet behind him. They came to a wall of concrete covered in brown mold, where the tunnel's integrity had given way under the weight of a massive concrete slab that penetrated inside it. The tunnel descended underneath the slab, and James figured that the tunnelers had been forced to carve out this passage, maybe by hand. James twisted and laid on his back in order to maneuver himself through the opening and still be able to see where he was going. The shaft curved up again like a horseshoe, re-entering the framed tunnel. One of the infiltrators was waiting for them there. The man had been shot, but only wounded, and had made it this far during his flight. Getting past the tunnel blockage had to have taxed all his strength, because he was floating in the tunnel just beyond it, sucking his air and looking desperate. He recoiled from James as the Black Commando snaked around the blockage. He was holding onto one shoulder with all his remaining strength, but the blood was seeping out from between his fingers. James reached out and extracted the dying man's knife from his sheath and continued on. The man tried to grab onto James's arm, and the commando shook him off. He grabbed James again, and this time, McCarter wrenched off the man's hands. It was clear he didn't have the strength to swim any farther himself. He wanted them to get him out. McCarter wasn't about to compromise their search by dragging along the survivor. The swimmer had sealed his own fate, and the Phoenix Force leader didn't feel all that sorry for him. Still, he'd help the guy out if he was still alive when they came back this way. James led them down a long, steady slope as the tunnels seemed to be heading into the depths of the ocean. He paused when he noticed a faint luminescence above him and turned off his light. McCarter did the same, and they hung there in the darkness for a moment until they realized they were seeing a faint light coming through the gaps in the shattered concrete slabs that covered the tunnel. They swam on for another 10 yards before reaching the end of the tunnel, then continued out onto the floor of the Pacific Ocean at a depth of about 40 feet. There were no more of the infiltrators waiting for them, but they had left one of their vehicles behind. It was an underwater transport unit, an electric propeller-driven device like those used by scuba divers for rapid underwater locomotion. James recognized it at once. He had trained on and used SEAL versions of the unit. This one still had its load attached to it, a massive blue nylon rope netting containing 8 of the plastic chemical containers.
They've been running perimeter sweeps around the atoll for the last 80 minutes. They've come up with nothing.
I know those guys aren't going far without getting some surface transport. What about our friend in a tunnel?
We extracted him, but he's no help. He ran out of air about 15 minutes before we got to him.
Bloody hell. All right, give us a few minutes, will you?
Of course.
Alone?
Well, I hope you won't be too long. This is my office, after all.
Base?
This is Price. There are a couple of Navy craft coming in to help with the search, but they're not going to get there in time to do you any good.
Well, they can't get that far using those transports and in scuba gear.
Yeah, but they don't really have to. They just need to get as far away as they can and then sit there until they can get picked up by a surface vessel after dark.
Right. Dusk isn't very far away. We could use some suggestions.
We're working on some, Phoenix.
Like what?
Well, Bear's checking out the ship traffic in your vicinity.
What good will that do us?
I'm not sure.
Barb, those guys won't need a commercial freighter to move those containers. They could fit them into a fishing boat, even a big pleasure craft, or several different boats.
I'm sorry, that's the best we can give you, Phoenix.
Got it.
Hold on.
The men of Phoenix Force looked at each other, aggravated at being asked to hold while their targets were getting closer to their final escape. They had to move soon.
Okay, Bear, would you care to explain?
Hey, I just located an ocean cargo vessel called the Pride of Vancouver. It's a freighter used by Dualistic Dynamics Limited, based in Vancouver, apparently for special import-export jobs. It's never been implicated in anything illegal, nor has Dualistic Dynamics. But it's another subsidiary of a subsidiary of the Polari Corporation, and it's steaming across the Pacific Ocean right now. Less than 29 miles northwest of your position.
Can they get there underwater using their towing devices?
Unlikely. But they could certainly be meeting up with some sort of surface vehicle, as we hypothesized before, a few miles from here, which could tow them to the Vancouver.
After all, they have to be going somewhere.
The Mark V Special Operations craft was powered up on one of the Johnston Atoll piers minutes after Phoenix Force arrived, fully prepped. They boarded the SOC in a hurry, and McCarter shouted for immediate cast-off. The Navy driver complied, and they left the atoll behind in minutes.
How long since their estimated departure from the incinerator?
Just under 2 hours. We know they can't travel all the way to the Vancouver underwater, but we don't know when they'll choose to surface. That will make all the difference in determining if they'll have reached the Vancouver yet. They'll travel at just a few miles per hour below the surface. Once they move onto the water, their speed might be better.
How are we going in? Hard and loud?
No, too dangerous. The ship is an unknown entity in virtually every sense. We'll make this a clandestine probe and go hard once we've mapped the layout and defenses. We'll have to use our heads on this one, mate.
The moon had replaced the sun, a perfect orange half-circle on the horizon. Enciso was scanning the ocean with a pair of thermal imaging binoculars.
There's our baby.
Soon they were all able to see the lights of the vessel, while Enciso was watching for additional activity on the ocean and not finding it.
We'll have to keep in mind that this boat could be just what it says it is, a shipping vessel, engaged in no sort of illegal activity.
David, she stopped. Why else would she anchor here, of all places?
Let's just be bloody sure before we start shooting up the place.
Got it.
They parked the SOC and inflated the black rubber seal insertion raft, piling in and leaving the Navy driver with instructions to move himself away from the Vancouver by at least another few miles and wait for their call for extraction. The sailor was a young, quiet man named Glasby, who was taking his ask-no-questions orders seriously. The Vancouver was quiet, as if waiting for them, waiting for something. As they approached, they slipped their oars into the water carefully to avoid the sound of splashing. But as they drew near, they spotted movement on the deck. Four men watched from the starboard side of the ship, peering into the night with thermal binoculars.
Uh-oh.
They saw one of the watchmen waving over his companions and pointing out into the ocean.
They see our boat?
Manning was looking where the watchmen were indicating. He saw their SOC sitting still in the water.
Gillespie didn't move out far enough. Damn it!
Get on the radio. Tell him to get the hell out of here.
Gillespie, you're too close. Get out of here now.
How far out do you want me to go, sir?
Just go!
They're launching. We're gonna come around this end of the ship.
The others started rowing hard to move the black raft against the ship.
Gillespie, you're going to have company. Head back to the atoll at once.
I can't strand you guys here.
Go right now, and that's an order.
Right.
They fell into the black shadows that lay close to the rear hull of the Vancouver, where even the starlight didn't reach them. Dressed in matte black combat clothing and webbing, and painted with oily black combat cosmetics, the five members of Phoenix Force managed to go unseen. But the men in the vessels being launched by the Vancouver had their attention on the Navy Mark V. Two Kawasaki 1100 ZXI personal watercraft shot out from the cargo ship and accelerated through wide circles that pointed them in the direction of the Navy boat.
Rafe, check with your thermal binoculars. Is he moving?
Yeah, he's moving.
Both PWCs are pretty fast.
The leader of Phoenix Force felt a rising tide of helplessness. There was absolutely nothing he could do, nothing any of them could do, to help that innocent Navy driver.
And Caesar, he's not going to make it.
He saw the first vessel close in on the Navy boat, pulling alongside for a moment, then arcing away and accelerating to distance itself from the craft. And Caesar knew what had just occurred. Maybe Glasby never did. He never slowed the SOC.
Shit.
They're turning around. They're gonna see us. Let's get wet. Sink this raft.
The five men stepped over the side without hesitation. James and Hawkins stabbed the rubber raft repeatedly. They stayed low in the water, dog paddling easily to stay afloat, until the vessels drew near. Then they sank into the dark water and hovered against the hull of the vessel, just a few feet beneath the surface. Carter raised a hand and signaled the approach. Silently, stealthily, the five members of Phoenix Force moved alongside the hull of the cargo vessel to the watercraft slots. From the shadows, they observed the drivers climbing the rope ladders onto the deck. They had the Navy SEALs to thank for providing their hardware. The raft they had just sunk and black battle gear they were wearing had arrived with waterproofed Heckler & Koch MP5 submachine guns, as well as waterproofed harnesses for the suppressed handguns. Each man was also armed with a combat knife, useful for absolutely silent kills. The knives and suppressed handguns would help keep the probe clandestine for as long as possible. Then the MP5s would help clean up. Enciso was the first up the ladder, and he reached the top of the deck rail without noise, looking over the side onto the deck. He drew back suddenly. The Cuban was holding the ladder with one hand and had drawn a stiletto in the other. A man holding an AK-74 close to his chest suddenly appeared at the rail, frowning, and he didn't have time to react. When he was still, Enciso passed him down to Manning.
Thanks.
The big Canadian passed the corpse down the line. Hawkins was still waiting on the watercraft slip, and he wedged the corpse into the narrow space between the slip and the hull.
Now that's teamwork.
And Enciso now found the deck clear. He launched himself over the rail and raced across the open area, ducking into the shadows under a set of stairs next to a large electrical box. Manning had to wait while a man on the top deck passed by, then sprinted to Enciso's side. In minutes, the entire team had assembled on the deck.
James is with me. We'll go forward, check out the bridge. I don't want this ship going anywhere until we're finished with it. You blokes go off and see what you can determine in regards to our plastic pods from Johnston. Remember what our captain friend told us about those containers. One bullet hole could release enough of that stuff to finish everybody in the vicinity. So be careful.
What about our transportation off this rig?
Cal, your radio survived the dunking?
Yeah. I'm getting us online with Stony Man via Johnston's uplink.
Report the death to our Navy friend and request extraction.
No matter what they send, it'll take our ride a while to arrive.
Right. Let's try to keep our presence a secret as long as possible.
There were nods of agreement and understanding. Then, the two factions of Phoenix Force separated and moved in opposite directions. The probe began in earnest. James and McCarter crossed in darkness, pausing long enough to watch the activity on the opposite side of the ship through a narrow passage to the starboard side. The crew seemed to assume the approach would come from starboard and was concentrating its efforts there. Not that they were ignoring the port side. They were walking regular search patrols along it.
The crew's not that large. Won't take them long to figure out they're missing a member.
Yeah.
James quickly updated Stony Man Farm on their situation, including the loss of their Navy driver. Price paused when she heard the news. James knew how she was feeling. He understood that the death of a team member, however peripherally allied to her action teams, never failed to affect her. But she buried her emotions.
Hold on, Phoenix 3. I'll arrange other transportation. There's a Seahawk coming to you out of Johnston. It'll reach your position within 20 minutes, then hang around outside weapons range until you call for extraction.
Got that, Stony Man.
We can inflict a lot of damage in 20 minutes, right, Cal?
You better believe it.
And Cizo took the point, leading Manning and Hawkins among the shadows in quest of an access to the cargo holds of the vessel. Silent, the trio went undetected. Arriving at an open area on the deck, they found a pair of doors to a wide cargo hatch. The double doors were propped open with half-foot-long sections of 2x4s. Inside was darkness. Standing nearby was a hatch that clearly led into the belly of the Pride of Vancouver.
Here we go.
And Cizo swung the door wide and leveled his handgun into the darkness, then nodded to the others who followed him inside. Hawkins, with a last look around to ensure they had gone undetected, closed the door behind them. They descended the steps to a landing, where Enciso surveyed the cargo hold. Most of the floor space was filled with some sort of unstacked containers underneath a tarpaulin that was tightly tied to the steel supports in the walls. The huge hold was lit by just three dim fluorescent light fixtures set up high in the ceiling. Enciso continued to the floor of the cargo hold while Manning and Hawkins followed cautiously. All of them were very aware that there was just one way into the hold.
Check it out quick, Rafe. This is making me nervous.
We've got to be sure of this.
I know, man. Just hurry.
Manning looked at Hawkins and gestured to the door. His teammate nodded and retreated up the stairs to guard the doorway. And Cizo quickly untied the knot holding one of the tarpaulin corners to the wall and drew it back. Several translucent sky blue plastic shapes were revealed, plastered with ominous black and white decals showing a skull and crossbones. In several languages, bright red lettering warned that any exposure would be fatal.
Bingo.
Good. Now let's get out of here.
Suddenly, the door opened. Hawkins, already in position, made a grab, snatching at the wrist of the new arrival. Hawkins tucked the silenced Beretta into its armpit holster and took the dangling MP5 from his shoulder. The time for quiet was over. Earlier, McCarter and James moved from shadow to shadow to the fore of the Pride of Vancouver.
If they were smart, since they know we're coming, they'd turn on the lights.
If they were smart, they wouldn't be in his business.
Uh-oh.
McCarter saw it too. A single guard stood at the bottom of a set of steps leading to the bridge.
We could take him out. That would be risky. Shall we try to find another way in?
Such as?
There's got to be another companionway on the other side of the ship.
How are we supposed to get to the other side of the ship from where we are now? That guy's not gonna let us pass, and it's a long way to go back.
There's that passage that cuts through the deckhouse, 10 meters back.
Doesn't seem safe, man.
Got a better idea?
Hawkins edged out of the entrance to spot the shooter and targeted the first moving shadow he saw.
What's the situation?
We're in trouble. Three players to aft, well protected. Two more out in front.
I've got a frag grenade. Let's cut them down to size.
I call front.
Aft for me.
Just be damn careful not to send that thing through the cargo hatch. Even the blast that small might ignite the cargo.
Gotcha. Let's do it.
They stepped back to back out of the doorway. Manning spotted movement behind the exhaust flues and tossed the grenade in an arc that deposited the bomb almost on top of them. Hawkins threw his into the darkness behind the machinery where more figures were gathering. They retreated into the cover of the doorway. Manning and Hawkins stepped out of the doorway again, H&K subguns at the ready. Enciso joined them for a quick march across the deck, covering themselves in three directions like a three-pointed star. They made their way to the machinery, where they were against the rear wall of the deck and had adequate protection from the front.
Phoenix One, we're catching fire.
He was answered with a quick pair of taps from a Carter, meaning the Phoenix Force leader was in no position to reply verbally.
Guys can't talk at the moment.
Should we stay put?
I don't see us finding a better spot to hole up in.
TJ, take him down!
I got you, my sight. Come on, don't be shy.
Hawkins saw the barrel shuffle nervously behind cover and spied the man's kneecap. Hawkins calmly stepped down from his perch on the mini-crane as Enciso's earpiece chimed in.
Phoenix One here.
Go ahead.
What's your situation?
We've got the aft deck to ourselves now.
The cargo?
It's here.
Hang tight. There's a Seahawk coming out of Johnston to give us a ride home.
McCarter and James fell back against the wall of the narrow starboard to port corridor they had been traversing, each aiming their MP5s in either direction. They stood, ready for action, as a handful of men ran past the opening to the passage, all of them carrying rifles. But none of them noticed the Phoenix Force pair.
The guys must have caused a stir. Let's go.
James backed along the corridor as McCarter led them ahead to the starboard side of the vessel. They emerged into an area of the ship that was more brightly lit. Light equaled danger in the constricted confines of the Pride of Vancouver. But there was no one in sight, and they made their way boldly to the front of the ship in search of the bridge. When they found it, the companionway leading to it was empty.
Not bad.
It's gonna be tight if we have to defend ourselves on those stairs. Let's stay sharp.
You don't have to tell me.
McCarter picked up the distant sound of gunfire, but knew it was out of his control. He started up the steel companionway in a crouch, keeping an eye on the glass windows and the bridge above him, unable from his low angle to see any of the sailors he knew were there. James stayed close with him, watching the deck in all directions.
Phoenix One, we're catching fire.
McCarter reached for the button on his set, sending back a pair of beeps to Enciso that told him he was indisposed. The door opened, and a man with a wrinkled brow stepped out, looking for signs of the chaos occurring at the rear of the ship. James was already moving, bounding forward, and triggering into the first of two men on the bridge to draw his weapon. The small automatic never cleared its shoulder holster.
Looks like we got the bridge.
Yeah. Let's see how long that'll last.
Manning collapsed into a sit and snapped out the magazine that fed his MP5. The gunner hidden behind the control console got up his nerve and fired on the Phoenix Force trio. Manning saw the opening and took his shot.
Is that all of them?
All at once, the wounded man charged into the open, his face covered in blood. He stumbled to his knees and weakly aimed his AK-74 directly at the rear of the vessel, where a 500-gallon fuel barrel was mounted on a steel frame 4 feet above the deck. Manning saw his intention and achieved his target in a flash of movement. But not before the AK triggered a pair of rounds into the barrel, and a flash of liquid streamed out, drenching the wounded gunman.
Shit, what is it?
Fuel spill. I can't risk the shot.
Is it reefing the cargo?
Not yet. It won't be long.
Relax, it hasn't ignited.
Yet. That gunner's still moving. I don't want to be around when he does what I think he's gonna do. Cover me, TJ.
Shit! Gary, get down!
What's he trying to pull?
The guy isn't dead yet.
So what?
I think he wants to take us all with him.
Manning crawled to a control console for cover, and the wounded man turned weakly to look at him. The man grinned maniacally through his agony and held up his hand. Manning saw a small silver object. Manning got to his feet and ran back to the cover he and his teammates had chosen. The sudden surge of flame had brought the auto fire from the Vancouver crew to a sudden halt. Hawkins was already on the radio.
Phoenix One! We gotta get out of here! We gotta get out of here right fucking now!
We gotta get out of here! We gotta
shit.
Get out of here right fucking
Cal,
now!
Cal, get down! PJ, what's going on?
We got a fucking inferno! It's gonna engulf this end of the ship in any second! Where's that fucking Seahawk?
James was already switching frequencies.
What's your ETA?
3 minutes. I see the Vancouver now. You guys trying to burn the thing up?
We'll be dead in 3 minutes. We need to get out of here right now.
I hear you. Where will you be?
On the roof. Out. PJ, get to the roof.
Phoenix One, we are taking heavy fire. We can't go anywhere, let alone the roof. This thing's gonna blow.
Acknowledged. We will... Shit!
Ricardo squeezed his eyes shut to keep out the flying crystal splinters, feeling tiny nicks of glass against his face. Time was running out.
Hang on! I'm going to clear the playing field!
He opened his eyes long enough to make sure he actually got the grenade out through the gaping window frame, then shut them again and hit his face.
Let's move.
Ricardo jumped to his feet and headed for the door, barely glancing at the mess of human flesh and blood on the deck below that had once been, he could only guess, two human beings. He climbed onto the rail of the companionway, then hauled himself onto the roof of the deckhouse. James was right behind him. The two men raced along the length of the roof to the rear of the vessel, the clouds of oily smoke drifting past them, and Ricardo found himself struggling not to breathe despite his exertion. His mind was racing. Had the fire reached the cargo? How long until the chemicals ignited? The Briton saw the tongues of flame before he and James reached the edge of the roof, and he thought for sure his three teammates were dead already. Painted orange by the lake of fire that now covered half the deck, three grim-faced figures faced off with the gunners.
Cal?
On it!
Where's that Seahawk?
There!
The heavy Navy helicopter was rushing at them at what looked like an impossible speed, just a few feet over the ocean. For a moment, Ricardo thought the pilot would never be able to avoid crashing headlong into the Vancouver's hull, but he swept off the surface of the ocean and came to a sudden halt above the ship.
That's us on the roof!
I see you!
The three just below us are also with us! We need to take out the gunners toward aft before we can extract them! The moment that cargo starts to burn, we're all dead!
I'll see what I can do!
The Seahawk veered over the roof and extruded its long, flexible rope ladder. Ricardo and James grabbed at it.
Right! Now get to the deck to...
Pilot fed fuel to the rotors and lifted the Navy chopper into the air to avoid the sudden ball of superheated air that lifted off the deck, and James and Ricardo found themselves hanging with all their strength to keep from being flung 100 feet through the air onto the doomed ship or into the Black Sea.
Go back! Go back!
The Seahawk veered back the way it had come and descended rapidly, sending the two men on the flexible ladder plummeting to the deck through the clouds of smoke. A hand reached out of the smoke and grabbed the ladder. It was Manning. He hauled Hawkins to the rope ladder, and Ricardo grabbed him. The ex-ranger reached reflexively out, and they clambered up together. Then Enciso appeared out of the smoke and grabbed hold.
We're on! Go! Go!
The Vancouver spun wildly beneath them as the Seahawk's rotors raced and grabbed at the air, swinging the helicopter away from the ship. As they sped away, the black cloud suddenly became a putrid gray color. Ricardo climbed into the belly of the Seahawk and helped hoist the others in after him. He watched the flaming, belching ruin of the Pride of Vancouver grow smaller behind them, seeing the survivors stumble out onto the deck from the interior. He couldn't count them in the chaos, but guessed there were at least 15 men, grabbing at their throats and staggering. In seconds, they had all fallen to the deck or thrown themselves into the ocean. In a few more seconds, the flames and lights of the ship were lost in the fatal haze.
City Wharf, Astara, Azerbaijan.
Economically, in theory, things had been looking up for the Azerbaijani Republic for nearly a decade, ever since the signing of its first major oil deal in the mid-1990s with a Western consortium of oil companies worth $8 billion. More oil deals had come. At the speeches presented during the celebratory ceremonial signing of each agreement, it was pointed out that the money would help fund industrial development. Industrial development would raise living standards in Azerbaijan to the standards of the most successful of the former Soviet bloc nations, eventually even to the living standards of the West. Judging by what Mac Bolan observed on the streets of its major port city of Astara, those political promises had yet to be realized. In its place came the worst perversion of capitalism, organized crime. He traded the Land Rover first thing when he entered the city. In its place, he had gotten a Moskvich, a Russian car dating from the early 70s. It wasn't pretty, but Bolin's 5-minute test drive and under-the-hood evaluation told him it was in good shape. The owner was delighted to get the expensive European 4-wheel drive vehicle. He knew he was getting the better end of the deal. But Bolin knew he was much less visible in the Moskvich. And when he pulled to a stop on the Astara wharf outside a decrepit building that belonged to a front company owned by Arif Oguz, none of the dock workers gave him more than passing notice. Bolin was wearing a bulky, well-worn black leather bomber jacket, zippered to the collar, and he kept his hands in his pockets. When he entered the building, he found a large suite of cubicles and several desks piled with old paperwork. A stout woman in an outfit that was a mixture of Western professional and Muslim traditional came out of the back room frowning. Bolin smiled.
Do you speak English?
A little.
Great. I'm looking for a friend of mine.
Yes?
His hand came out of his coat to run his fingers through his hair, distracting her. And an instant later, the Beretta 93R appeared in the other hand, leveled at her chest. Her jaw dropped.
Arif Oguz. Never heard of him?
Suddenly, a figure burst from the back room, drawing a Makarov handgun. He spotted Bolin and aimed the gun, despite the fact that the woman blocked his view of the soldier.
Now, ma'am, I ask you a question.
Hotel Astara Royal! Oguz owns it! It is where he stays!
Thanks. That's all I wanted to know.
Oguz will kill you! He'll send you to hell! And I will be joyful when you are dead!
Like I've never heard that one before.
Bolin left. Within a mile of the airport, a city block had been gutted and remade, the streets repaved, the building facades resurfaced. This was where politicians, businessmen, and other VIPs would bring their international guests, who were led to believe that this was what Astara was really like. In that area, where money talked, Arif Oguz had built his hotel. It angered Bolin when he found drug merchants living in luxury, insulating themselves from the horrors of the street, horror they helped sustain through their trade. When the soldier entered the lobby of the hotel, he realized Oguz had insulated himself very well indeed. It was a magnificent lobby, with a marble-tiled floor draped at virtually every step with expensive handmade rugs, with potted plants growing in hand-carved wooden boxes, with uniformed waitstaff lingering at every corner. The atmosphere was cooled, cleaned, and dehumidified so thoroughly, one could forget this was in a city sweltering in the fumes of one of the most polluted bodies of water on the planet. Bolin was a changed man from the one who had stormed Samkir. Parking his Moskvich blocks away, he'd changed into a fresh white shirt, suit, and tie, courtesy of a stony man contact. The suitcase was expensive, but looked appropriately well used.
Excuse me, do you have a room? I'm afraid I don't have a reservation.
Why, yes, sir.
Actually, I'd like a nice suite, if you've got one.
Of course, sir. Will you be paying by credit?
Of course. Is there any other way?
No, sir. Thank you, Mr. Belasco.
Mike Belasco.
The clerk gave him the Prince of Astara suite at an exorbitant rate, even by Western standards.
Does the television get CNN?
Of course, sir. Let me get the elevator for you, Mr. Belasco.
Mac Bolin stepped into an elevator decorated with hand-polished brass and ostentatious weavings. It took him to the fourth of 5 floors. The controls required a room key card for operation and an actual key to get to the 5th floor. He entered a suite the size of a small house, with a bedroom, sitting room, parlor, and kitchen with a stocked bar. Vast stretches of pale ivory porcelain tiles were softened by more hand weavings from throughout the Middle, Central, and Far East. A handful of lazy rattan ceiling fans and draperies hung from the ceiling throughout the suite to separate the rooms. Bolin wasn't the type to be impressed by rich surroundings, and now was certainly not the time to gawk. He surveyed the room, looking out the windows to find the best method of entry to the floor above him. He had several windows to choose from, and a walkout balcony that looked onto the avenue below, crowded with foot traffic. Above him was another balcony, made of mortared brick, an easy access point to the suite once night fell. If all went well, Arif Oguz would never know what hit him. Dusk was still several hours away, and the soldier was loath to waste them. He wondered how he might fill his hours in a productive way. He dialed the Juilliard restaurant on the first floor.
Mr. Belasco in 404, can I still get lunch at this hour?
He took the stairs down, straightening his tie as he reached the ground floor and stiffening his stride. The suit routine was one of the easier roles he'd ever played. The restaurant was designed to look as exclusive as the hotel, with just 9 tables in a raised area at the rear of the lobby. He took a booth, the only patron, and ordered a vodka. The waiter was dapper and silent and disappeared like a shadow. Bolin propped the newspaper on the table and watched over the top of it. He had a feeling he wouldn't be alone for long. He waited for less than 5 minutes before a man in a Western business suit exited the elevator and exchanged glances with one of the bellhops Bolin had noticed earlier. The suit approached in an easy stroll, adopting a well-practiced smile as he mounted the steps into the restaurant.
Mr. Belasco?
Yes.
How do you do? I am Haji Abilov, personal secretary to the owner of this hotel.
Abilov, a tiny, wiry figure with a vast, smooth forehead and a heavy, graying mustache, extended a hand and Bolin took it in a firm grip.
Good afternoon.
Forgive me for intruding. May I join you?
Certainly.
Ah, thank you. My curiosity got the better of me, I'm afraid. We don't get many visitors from America, and I couldn't help but come over and welcome you to Azerbaijan.
Thank you. To be honest, I hadn't planned on coming to Astara, but I was in Baku for a week and felt like I had enough time to spare to check out the situation here, too.
On business, I assume?
Yes. I'm with Investing International Consultants. Here's my card.
Ah, thank you. In New York?
Yes. We specialize in Central and South American opportunities for U.S. and European manufacturing investors, but we're trying to expand our expertise into the Central Asian states. We see tremendous opportunities here for manufacturing.
Really? We don't have much manufacturing in Azerbaijan now. Our economy is driven largely by oil and other raw materials.
Such as opium and heroin, Bolin thought.
Right now, this is true. But we see great promise for expanding manufacturing here. We may plan to create a division to facilitate its development.
That would be a great benefit to the people of this city. You know, Astara is not a wealthy city.
All of Azerbaijan would benefit from the added employment, of course.
You know, my employer knows municipal leaders throughout the region. I'm sure he would be able to make some appointments for you. How long will you be in the city?
A day or two at the most. As I said, I'd never even planned to visit more than Baku. I don't think I caught your employer's name.
Mr. Oguz.
I'd love to meet him. Get his perspective on the regulatory climate for business in Astara.
That may be possible, Mr. Belasco.
Actually, I have nothing planned for this evening outside of sitting in front of CNN. Would he be available this evening?
I shall pass the message along to my employer.
Of course. I thank you for your time. You know how to find me.
Enjoy your lunch, Mr. Belasco.
Bolin ordered a full meal, finding it excellent, and ate it thoughtfully, taking his time. Maybe his instincts were off, but he got the impression that Oguz was, in fact, in the city, which meant he might be in the hotel right now. Which meant that as soon as the darkness closed in, Bolin and Oguz were destined to meet, whether Oguz wanted the meeting or not.
Of course I'm interested in meeting him. If he is what he says he is, then it will make for excellent public relations. If he isn't, then it will be the best possible opportunity to slip him up and identify him.
I would be much happier if I were able to make that determination prior to the meeting. Then we would know what kind of reception to give this Belasco.
Arif Oguz was sitting at a wide dining table in his suite, with newspapers from around the world spread out before him. He didn't give Abalov his full attention. The man didn't require it. The men had known each other for decades and were the closest of friends. There was no formality between them.
One man attacks Ekstafa, and the reports say he's an American. The same man attacks Samkir, and the survivors say he is an American. Then there is an attack at our wharves. Again, an American. They say he's trying to find you. Well, he found you.
Ogus sat back in his chair, exposing his face to the light. He was a hideous-looking man, with a hawk nose and a face that had been ravaged by a skin condition when he was younger. His black hair was combed as well as he was able, but was naturally wild. His brows were heavy and too low on his forehead, giving him a Neanderthal look. But his physical appearance was made incongruous by a neat tailored suit and stiff posture, and mannerisms that were so careful they were almost exaggerated.
I do not see it as obvious, coming here to this hotel to seek me out. Too bold, especially for an American.
Trust my intuition here, Arif. The man I met in the restaurant was as cold as death. I could see it in his eyes. He was the one.
I will meet this man. If he is the man who we want, then we shall make the determination and simply shut him down. After we convince him to identify his support staff in-country, the General would be very happy to get such information.
The executioner didn't often get invited to formal dinner parties. They weren't quite his speed. He didn't own a dinner jacket, and wouldn't take one on a mission, even if he did. Just the three of them attended the dinner party anyway. Himself, Abalov, and Ogus. The crime lord tried to hide behind cultivated European manners and dapper dress. He stood stiff and tall, with one hand in his jacket pocket, as if he were the Prince of Wales, shaking Bolin's hand stiffly, gesturing for him to make himself comfortable. As Bolin had expected, the suite covered the entire top floor of the hotel, and he was taken through a large vestibule decorated with fresh-cut flowers, through a small sitting room, finally to stop in a large parlor abutting a huge dining area on one side, with a kitchen glimpsed beyond that. A closed set of double doors headed into what Bolin assumed was personal rooms. Bedrooms, dressing rooms, bathrooms. His soldier's intuition kicked in as he was led to the sitting area. He had the distinct impression he was entering a trap. He had expected it, naturally. He had deemed the risk worth the opportunity to get face to face with Arif Ogus.
Drink, Mr. Belasco?
Single malt scotch, if you have it.
Of course.
Soon after, the drinks appeared, and Bolin sipped his and nodded appreciatively. But his real concentration was on the room itself. Whether any members of the waitstaff seemed a little nervous, or if their clothes weren't hanging right. So he listened for any sound out of the ordinary. But the only sounds he could pick out were the clinking of silverware and plates and the sound of a firearm from the other room. Maybe. Maybe it was just his instincts on high alert. But he had learned to trust those instincts implicitly.
There have not been many jobs with hope of advancement for very long now. I hope that both you and Investments International Consultants find the city of Astara has much to offer in terms of manufacturing opportunities. We have plenty of intelligent people, and in the city they are all literate. They want to work. Azerbaijanis want the opportunities.
I've certainly seen that, Mr. Ogus. My company knows there are people here to do the work. We're more concerned with infrastructure issues.
Such as?
Mainly the civil war issue.
Ah, the civil war is far away from Astara. None of those people have made their presence known in this city. Even if they do succeed in breaking away from this country, it will not affect us. They add little. Their departure will mean little.
But if protracted fighting occurs?
Neither side can afford it. And neither side has anything to offer foreign partners that would motivate them to lend support to either side. So any war would be brief and benign.
A benign war, Mr. Ogus.
Maybe I'm playing it down a little. My point is, though, that any war by the independence groups can't go far, and its outcome will have little effect on this part of Azerbaijan.
Well, the recent gas attacks in this country make me wonder about that.
Bolin watched his abrupt shift in the direction of the conversation affect both Arif Oguz, who stiffened, and Haji Abilov, who was sitting silent in a chair with an untouched drink.
My partners in New York got somewhat panicky when they started seeing the reports splashed across CNN. They wanted me to return home at once and forget the whole thing. It took some doing to convince them I was far from the vicinity of the terrorist attacks.
Oguz nodded and seemed to be searching for a correct response. The sound from the bedroom told Bolin all he needed to know. Gunmen were positioned there, waiting for the moment Oguz decided to give the orders to take Bolin out. Bolin had come unarmed, save for a calf-sheathed fighting knife. A firearm would have been detected and blown his cover immediately.
I believe we're ready for dinner.
I'd like to clean up before we eat. Can you direct me to the washroom?
Abilov silently gestured to a short hallway just off the sitting area, and Bolin found a spacious washroom with an earth-colored ceramic tile floor and a wide window covered by wooden lattice shutters. He opened the shutters and evaluated his situation. The window was about 50 feet from the hard ground, and a few feet above it was an iron railing that surrounded the roof. In the dark of early evening, there was some foot traffic on the street, but no one was noticing him. Bolin had to make sure that continued. The sounds would muffle his escape. He quickly crouched on the windowsill and stood, holding onto the top of the window as he made a grab for the roof railing with the other hand. The stretch was too great, and he had to let go of the window and trust that the rail would hold his well-muscled 200-pound frame. It wiggled slightly as he transferred his weight to it. Highly attuned to the passage of time, he swung along the iron rail, his forearms scraping against the concrete lip of the roof, and stopped at the next window. He guessed it was one of the bedrooms, and the window here was larger. He watched the shears for a few seconds and saw the movement of shadows. That didn't tell him who was in the room, how many of them there were, or how well they were armed, and he was running out of time. Oguz and Abilov were going to get suspicious in a hurry when he didn't emerge from the bathroom. He had to make a blind entrance. The soldier held onto the rail with one hand and extracted the fighting knife with the other, using it to slowly draw the shears away from the window. He spotted a pair of gunners, one pacing, the other stretched out in a chair near the window, both with Russian-made Stechkin machine pistols held close to their bodies. They were watching the closed door, but either of them was bound to spot Bolin at any second. He stepped silently on the sill and grabbed the top of the window frame as he released the roof rail above. The gunners were instantly alerted by the sound and turned on him, but were too stunned by his arrival to fire their weapons. Bolin leapt to the floor and lashed his foot savagely at the man in the chair. He grabbed both dropped machine pistols, tucking one in the back of his pants under his suit jacket. He knew his cover was blown. No use just waltzing back in now. He strode quickly to the corner and leveled his gun into the living area, where a collection of armed gunners were still dealing with the confusion of one of their own going down at their rear. That confusion turned to sudden terror when the Stechkin pointed at them and they stared into the steely eyes of the executioner. Bolin followed and stood amidst the three bodies as he dropped the first Stechkin and swept the now deserted living area with the second. There was a shadow of dark movement from the dining room, and the butler appeared, triggering a Makarov pistol held in both hands. Bolin darted to the left to avoid the fire that homed in on him at shoulder level, and sent a swift burst from the Stechkin into the dining room. The kitchen door moved and an arm appeared, then a face. It was Haji Abilov, who tossed a small, heavy object in Bolin's direction. The soldier leapt over a small ottoman as he identified what it was Abilov threw. Abilov appeared around the corner looking for his body, then pulled back in a rush when he spotted the soldier coming to bear with the machine pistol. Abilov's hand appeared again long enough to fling another grenade into the living area. There was just one avenue of escape, and he took it, running for the balcony at the end of the sitting area. As he stepped on the balcony, he dropped the Stechkin, leaned over the rail at the waist, and grabbed the rail uprights, ignoring the wildly swinging view of the ground five stories down. His upper body swung over the rail just as the blast came. The shockwave missed his body, but turned the contents of the sitting room to dust and shrapnel. Bolin's hands felt like they were suddenly on fire. He used all his will to ignore the searing pain, to force the muscles of his hands to keep working despite the trauma. Then the pain ebbed slightly, and he slowly pulled himself along the uprights to the top of the railing. His hands were covered in black soot, burned in some places and glistening red in others. Somehow, he managed to lean over the railing and tumble inside the balcony. Inside the penthouse, a lazy drapery fire burned, and clouds of dust were starting to settle. But there was no sound. Haji Abalov and Arif Oguz had successfully escaped the executioner.